Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Second Act Actors. I'm your host, Dr. Janet McMorty, and I was and still am a medical doctor simultaneously trying to pursue a career in acting. Before I introduce my guest this week, I wanted to let you know about a really cool class online that's starting up next week. So I was scrolling through social media, as you do, and I came across this class that was advertised. I think it was on an acting school website that I had seen, an acting school that I'd been to. And, you know, I wanted to do some research before I came on here to talk about it, just in case it's a scammy scam. I don't want anyone to get scammed because there's so many scams out there, especially for actors. Oh my God. So I did my due diligence and I researched it and I said, oh my gosh, this class sounds really, really great. I've never heard of a class like this before. It sounds super unique. So I reached out to the creator of the class, the teacher of the class, Oliver, and told him I really liked his idea. And he said, well, would you mind talking about it on your podcast? I said, absolutely. Again, he's vetted by a lot of really fantastic professionals in this industry, both in Toronto and Montreal. Again, this is an online class, so you can take it anywhere in the world. So he wrote out kindly a lovely introduction to his class that I'm going to read for you today to promote it because it sounds like a really cool idea. And it also ties in really nicely with my guest this week for sure, but my guest next week for sure. So here it is. This is what Oliver wrote, the creator and instructor of this class. So, are you tired of waiting for your acting career to start? Are you not being submitted for the right roles? Most of us. Do you feel like the industry hasn't seen you yet? Oh my God, how much of a struggle is this? So stop waiting and start creating. Now, okay, how often have you heard this as an actor? Oh, if you're not getting the roles you want, make the roles for yourself. Well, how the heck do you do this, okay? So, Oliver Ward is the expert when it comes to helping actors create and produce their own work. He's been creating his own content for over 20 years, and he's made all the mistakes so you don't have to. Oliver has designed a course for you to take from a blank page to the full produced 5-minute short film in 10 weeks. 10 weeks! When you create a short film, you're creating your own opportunities. The opportunity to play the role that you want to play. The opportunity to tell the story you want to tell. The opportunity to show the industry who you are. For your business and for your brand, it is the best networking tool. In an energetic sense, it's showing and telling the universe what you want. Another acting class, another headshot, another meeting with your agent will not change your opportunities the way that creating your own work will. Look into any of your favorite actors' careers and you find at some point that they created their own work. You can do it at the beginning of the career, mid-career, or even as an established actor. In any scenario, it's a game changer. It's a career accelerator. So again, that was written by Oliver, but I could not agree more. Again, I'm going to reiterate, how many times have you as an actor heard, you need to create your own work if you want to get the roles that you want, and then you're like, how do I do that? And then nobody tells you, and then you're paralyzed and you don't do anything and you just sit around waiting for the auditions to drop in your inbox, which sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So if you're interested in this class, again, he's fully vetted. I did my due diligence. I checked him all out. This is not a scam. Scam. If you're ready to get started, reach out to Oliver today. Oliver Ward is his name. ActorProducerBlueprint@gmail.com. Let me say that again. ActorProducerBlueprint@gmail.com. I'm going to put all the information in the show notes if you're interested in this class. It starts next week. That is next week, August 17th. It is online, so you can take it wherever you are in the world. Definitely check it out. Now, my guest this week is Corby Stevens. Corby is a pastor turned voiceover actor, improv performer, and stand-up comedian, and professional yo-yo children's entertainer extraordinaire. I'm so excited for you to hear this story, this wonderful, wonderful human being. There are so many interesting parallels that we go into between preaching, you know, faith-based ministry, and stand-up comedy. We also do a really interesting deep dive into kind of history of improv and stuff like that, which I really like because I'm getting into improv a lot. Please enjoy Corby Stevens. Whereabouts in the world are you located?
I am in Vancouver, Washington, which is directly across the border from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. I grew up in Vancouver, Canada.
Yeah. See, now you don't have to do this, but everywhere I go, I have to say Vancouver, America. If I go to England or wherever I travel, it's super fun. Vancouver, USA. Even in Seattle, I have to say Vancouver, Washington.
Really?
Yep.
Oh my gosh. It's funny, I did some schooling in London, Ontario, Canada. And yeah, you kind of have to do that. No, not Queens, London. No, the tiny town in the middle of nowhere, Ontario, Canada. Mm. Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah, so tell me your story. I was reading your website before we came on a little bit, but tell me, you have a fascinating story.
I've even forgot what was up there. gosh, let's see. Born and raised in Vancouver. Come from a primarily musical family on my dad's side. I was not a keen musical performer per se, but I was always involved or taking community classes that involved puppets or writing or making something. I did play instruments in middle and high school. I played trumpet, and I was first chair all the way through and never practiced, and that's not a bragging point. That's just the some of the innate genetic ability combined with being in a little pond. Because as soon as you go to university, you realize, oh no, you suck, buddy. You needed to practice, because there's some amazing players in college. But in high school, I decided to get into drama class the last 2 years of school, and that was really fun because the teacher had recently embraced using learning improvisation to learn how to act. Instead of just improv for its own sake, it was we're going to use this as a tool to become better actors. So she had some people from it was Seattle Theater Sports. Now it's I just forgot the name, under something Productions. They're in the Pike Place Market. Anyway, came down and did a number of workshops for her before I started. And that's relevant because after high school, when I went to UW, University of Washington, I went there and took classes from the same people. So I just really always loved improvisation. I'm terrified of memorizing scripts. Terrified. So that's kind of where that starts. You might just keep plowing through.
Yeah.
Story.
I'm going to say one little thing.
Jump in anytime.
It's funny because most people I chat with are the flip opposite.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
terrified of improv, and yeah. they're like, please give me a script.
Oh, man. Words in the right order don't always come out of my mouth. So, no bueno. Yeah, one of the high school plays, it was dress rehearsal time, and we got stuck in an endless loop doing off script, because I kept going back to the same, and everybody was so, it was just, I still have PTSD apparently from it. Anywho, let's see, improv in college. Where did we go from there? Then some life circumstances changed. I am a person of faith, so if I bring that up, I'm not preaching it, it's just part of the story.
Yeah.
I went to college to become a music teacher. I wanted to be like Mr. Holland before there was a Mr. Holland opus. And things shifted to a more ministry, church-focused pursuit. I still wanted to use those skills. They were very valuable skills in that area, so I sort of tried to weave those in there. But following performing was no longer the priority. So I changed colleges. Before going off to the next school, I became reacquainted with a girl I met in middle school who had also gone through some life changes while at UW, ironically. And we kind of came back home at the same time and got reacquainted and got engaged and went off to school and got married at school. And we've been married for almost 28 years now.
Cool.
But she also comes from a musical family, which is kind of fun. all that to say, marriage and family and providing for my family came first. It just did. I still tried to have fun doing performing stuff, but having those kinds of priorities early in life can really shape you positively. But if your pursuit is to become a performer, it's not always compatible, because performing requires so much of you, especially if you want to be like a successful professional performer. You have to go where the work is. The work takes so much time, and you have to really have a family that's behind you in that to do that well. But we had different set of priorities then. Still looking for opportunities. And while I'm working in the tech field, I kind of went back and forth between paid ministry work and then to pay the bills. I'm an IT guy, which is what I'm doing now. A friend from University of Washington said, I'm doing this crazy job. I think you'd be great at it. And it's being, how did he phrase it? Being a yo-yo man. Yep, that's the response. It's laughter and like, what are you talking about? So around Seattle, there was a company based in north of Seattle that did assemblies, character education assemblies for schools. But they used the yo-yo as sort of a tool to communicate with kids. So the theme of the program was based around the name Ned. Never give up, encourage others, and do your best. So you told a story with the yo-yo, who was a character that would, you know, go around the world, and you could make shapes with the string. So he went to England because you can make the British flag, you can make an Eiffel Tower, just chased by aliens, this whole crazy cartoony adventure. And then communicate the message to the students, and then end with like a magic trick with balloons or a couple different options. So that's a 45-minute program that I got to do. The most times in a day that I did it was 5 times, but at least 1 time a day, 1 to 3 times a day, 5 days a week, all the school year.
Wow.
And to do that, I had to move to Pittsburgh, all the way across the country, because they tried to station, at the time, they tried to station people in different cities and kind of work a territory around that city. So that's where I moved. But they would also, to kind of hit smaller markets, you would get to go to travel once every 6 weeks or so for a week. So I got to go to 31 states. I think I did the math one time. I did over 1,200 shows for over 125,000 students. I did get to go to Vancouver, Canada 1 week. I went to England 4 summers because they have a different school schedule than we do. And I got to go to Australia 2 times.
Oh my God.
To play with yo-yos and talk to kids as a human cartoon for 45 minutes.
Wow.
It was, yeah. It looks weird on a resume.
So cool. So cool. I have a very, very triggering thing in my mind. Why do I think that I know it's not triggering in a bad way. Sorry, I shouldn't have, that's a horrible word to say. I feel like I've seen this.
You might, there, depending on how old you were, I was doing this 2002 to 2005, and there were about a dozen of us around the country, but we would go to Canada together for a week.
Yeah,
so we went to
I'm
BC.
A bit older, but maybe so. Both my parents were teachers.
Yeah,
and my mom was in the elementary system. Mm-hmm. So I swear to you, and I did not. I knew you'd done some. I knew the yo-yo stuff because I read your website, but I did not prep this before. But like, I swear, something like this was at in one of my mom's schools.
It could very well be because the owner's been doing it longer. So.
It's cool.
Very possible.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So neat. How do you learn how to do the yo-yo? This has nothing to do with the other questions I want to ask you, but I'm just so curious.
It's like any skill. It's practice, practice, practice.
Yeah.
It is Band-Aids for a while until you build up a callus on your finger because that string really will rub it raw. And then just a patient teacher.
Yeah.
Like my, they've, I, I got hired, and the very, very first thing, based on a schedule, because I think I replaced somebody who they hired and then let go because it wasn't a good fit. But it was Easter, and we went to Washington, D.C. to the White House for the annual Easter egg roll event that they do. They bring in children's entertainers. That was my very, very, very first thing I did with these other guys. And I didn't even know how to yo-yo then. I just, I went. But traveling with them, they would, you know, work with you to on the tricks. And you learn the tricks that tell the story. So you're, it, there's a purpose behind it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of practice.
Did your improv work come into play with that? Like, was that part of it?
It did. Because there's the story piece, which, you know, something might go wrong and you kind of have to fake it for a while. I did hit myself in the head twice with the yo-yo. That was fun. I'm bleeding one time pretty profusely. Oh, and you have to, you know, you're in front of 600 kids and you don't want to be like, oh my God, I made it. You have to be like, I remember like, hey, yo-yo man needs a Band-Aid, because I had some like tissue up and they were, and I like eyeballed the teacher. Yo-yo man needs a Band-Aid. They scurried off and got something.
Oh my gosh.
And then the middle chunk of the show was you would talk to kids. So you would go out and interview. So that always lent itself to a little bit of improv and being in the moment.
Yeah. Oh, that's so neat.
Yeah.
Do you still do that now, or what has progressed from there?
From the yo-yo thing?
Yeah.
Oh, let's see. That ended in 2005. So a couple more moves around the country, involving some ministry stuff and some IT stuff. While we were in one town for 7 years, while I was pastoring a church, my kids, who are now in their early mid, oh my gosh, my son just had his 26th birthday. We, their sort of middle high school years, got involved in the community theater, as my wife did too. And I kind of on an auxiliary basis got involved. Because again, I'm terrified of memorizing, but I would kind of go in and consult and do improv workshops. That's I think I really like that more, helping people discover how to do it, not like instructing and telling do this, do that, but like let's find it, let's learn it, and you discover your own rhythm. So it was kind of always there, involved in some level. Most recently, the two more intentional things I've tried to do are get into voiceover work. And I finally, this is where the second act stuff comes into play, doing voiceover work and taking a stab at doing stand-up comedy based on some friends who also took a stab at it. So,
nice.
Yeah, that was interesting. Pre-COVID.
And then the COVID. Yeah.
And then, yeah.
What brought about your interest in voiceover?
I have always, well, let's see. There's kind of a crossover between voiceover and stand-up. My dad, in addition to having lots of music records, had a number of comedy albums. So, like, Steve Martin Records, which was his stand-up, but also, like, Cheech and Chong Records, which were sketches. There was a Jonathan Winters album. There was a George Carlin record. So, hearing comedy, hearing delivery. I loved cartoons. I'm one of those people who I like the making of better than I like the thing itself. So I grew up on Star Wars. I loved the making of Star Wars probably more than the actual movies. So I like seeing how the sausage is made. And so when it comes to cartoons, voices fascinated me. How, you know, Mel Blanc, how did one guy do all of those Warner Brother voices? Astounding. And then, you know, cartoons were huge for marketing mostly in the 80s and 90s. I loved voice stuff, even commercials, you know, because you could act without having to, you had a script in front of you, you could still play and have fun. You could be in your pajamas if you wanted to. It always intrigued me, but I didn't know how to get into it, or, you know, how do you do that when you live in Vancouver and all that stuff's in LA and New York and now Dallas and Chicago. So, I went through a course online thing, through a thing called Such a Voice. And I got paired up with a great teacher, because you can learn commercial focus or you can learn animation focus or both. So I did the both route. This was when COVID hit, so I also had the fun extra time to build a voiceover booth in my garage. I don't build stuff. I have a circular saw and a drill and YouTube. And so I built a booth. It's still standing. It never collapsed. Pretty soundproof. And I say tried to get into that because by the time I got into it, it's pretty saturated world. I should have done it 5 years ago when I heard about it first, but it's pretty competitive. There's a lot of work to be done, but the more saturated it is, it also means less pay. And if you're willing to kind of get your feet wet and try to build a foundation with making less, and you have the time because you have another job, then you can probably do it. But you know, you're not necessarily going to get that, you know, Ace Hardware commercial deal, or you know, national campaign, or even necessarily a local one, because that also depends on where you live. So all kinds of factors for voiceover.
Yeah. What do you find is the similarity between that and your stand-up that you're doing now?
The stand-up was not currently doing it. Again, COVID hit and everything closed. Stand-up is, a lot of it is about, of course, delivery. It's phrasing and pacing and timing. So a lot of voiceover when it comes to like commercial ads is the same thing. It's very deliberately written. It's written very focused, with, you know, emphasis in certain spots. So it's, as far as delivery goes, it's very similar. Obviously you're writing completely differently, but some of the performance skills are very similar.
You said you worked in like faith-based ministry.
Yeah.
Would you call, like, excuse my total ignorance here, like as a pastor?
Uh-huh.
Like a preacher? Is that the right
sure.
word? I'm so sorry. Yeah. There have to be some pretty big parallels between that and stand-up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you could say that I performed for 7 years once a week, if not more.
Right.
The way I would teach or preach was fairly loose. There are some people who will write out a full script and read from that script. I was more of an outline-based person, so I had sort of things I wanted to say and highlight. But in fact, I was just talking to my wife about this the other night because we were watching somebody on TV who was reading, or from on YouTube, reading from a script. And I said, do you like the script reading kind of preaching, or do you like the not? She says, oh, the not. Because as you are talking to people, you are seeing how things are landing. And as you see how things are landing, you might shift how you say things or even what you say to better get your points across. So there is some improvisational skill there, but it really is the better you know your material, the more flexible you can be. A lot of people think it's the opposite. If you just, you just have a few notes and you kind of freewheel and say whatever you want. If something goes off the rails, you're like, I don't even know what to do next.
Right.
But the better prepared you are, I think that's why, like, stage performers, when something happens and they can go off script in character for a few moments and then get right back in because they know the material.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a fair amount of crossover there.
Yeah. Anything else that you've noticed from your careers that you had prior to this that you've been able to transfer over? Both, I know you mentioned you worked in tech as well, too. Anything else that you've noticed have been kind of transferable skills, or at least things that have helped you kind of push forward in this new second act?
People skills, for sure.
Yeah.
Talking to people, dealing with people, listening to people. It's one of my favorite quotes about improv from a Canadian brother named Keith Johnstone from the Loose Moose Theater, I think in Saskatchewan. I could be totally wrong. He said that improv is not about being funny. It's about listening, responding, and letting the comic moments take you by surprise. So learning how to listen and then being able to respond in that moment, those are just huge life skills. Like, I think if more people could shut up and listen, I think a lot of situations in our lives would be a lot better. Because we'd be able to respond more appropriately and then maybe have a laugh about it. Who knows?
Yeah.
So that those kinds of skills have definitely been transferable. Even in IT, you can be in a panic because this very important email can't be sent out, and you're going to be, it's okay. Let's calm down. Let's people workshop this. And then we'll tech troubleshoot it and everything will be fine.
Is there anything that's been, besides how saturated the industry is, but anything else that's been surprising for you, kind of getting into the more VO world?
Surprising. There's a lot more stuff out there to do than I would have thought of. I've been sort of, when I completely dove into trying to do VO, I signed up and paid for some of the larger services where jobs are listed. Voices.com, VOPlanet.com. These aren't commercial pitches. These are just the places. Voices 123. These are places where you are the better paying jobs. But if you go to places like Upwork or Fiverr, I don't know how people make money doing this, but there are lots of jobs for doing like YouTube voiceover videos. So like a lot of the 10-minute videos that are about a particular athlete or who knows what, they're kind of like little mini news pieces, but they're not really news. They're just stuff people are interested in. They need a voice. And so they'll pay not a whole lot, but, you know, something to do it. And the more optimistic mindset would be, well, maybe somebody will hear that and that will lead to something else. So, yeah, surprising. For me, the surprising stuff might be more of what I learned about my own sound and my own voice and limitations, I suppose. The more you listen to your voice, the more you recognize you do have an accent no matter where you're from. So like, yep, I definitely have a West Coast. Some jobs actually list a Portland accent. Like, what's a Portland? I don't even know what that is, but I'm pretty sure I have it. Yeah, weird. That's also kind of surprising. So I don't. Yeah.
I remember taking a voiceover, like an intro to voiceover class.
Yeah.
And we did an activity where we turned off all. This was on Zoom, of course. It was a pandemic.
Yeah.
We turned off all our cameras. And somebody spoke and just read lines of dialogue kind of in their natural voice.
Mm.
And people just had to type in the chat what they heard.
Yeah.
Like, are they rich or poor? Are they from the city or from the country?
Yeah.
And like, how would you describe? And for me, that was so eye-opening for probably a very similar thing like you were saying, so how surprising it is.
Yeah.
Because we hear ourselves in one, and see ourselves, honestly, in one way. The rest of the world is like, nope, this is what you are. Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever done something like that before?
Not in a group. And I think that's a great exercise that maybe would have only manifested itself in a Zoom era where you can be a part and listen and just type as opposed to verbally express.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could do that in a group setting somehow, somewhere, everybody's backs are turned or who knows what. But that does make me think of, again, back to the listening, but as a performer, whatever kind, especially if you're one up front, we don't often listen enough to how we sound or how the overall performance sounds. So I remember going to rehearsals for my kids in their community theater shows, watching the rehearsal, and people are off book, and I'm listening to what's going on. I'm like, oh, the director, who was an amazing director and worked amazing with kids and with adults, her focus, which makes sense to me, was on how did it look? Where was the blocking? How did the lighting look? Were the lines going out okay? Was the acting well enough? And I always wanted to tell her, okay, in this next rehearsal, turn around in your seat. Stare at the back of the house and listen to what's happening on stage. And you will hear a whole nother world of how to improve the performance. Because, we're a very visual people, and we're always typically about how does this look? How does my appearance look? What does my face look like? What does my costume look like? But as important is how do you sound? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I found very helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's got to be a really tough thing for voiceover. And I can imagine, I know I struggled with it as a more stage actor history.
Yeah.
Now coming into voiceover where you don't have that. Like you were saying, you can do it in your jammies.
Yeah.
So the only tool you have to create visualizations of who you are to whoever you're auditioning for or whatever, because they haven't put your voice to a cartoon yet, is your voice.
Yeah.
And if you haven't ever listened to it and what, it sounds like with your eyes closed saying, who do I picture when I hear this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's tough to kind of, market yourself. I don't know if that's the right word, but
it is.
Know yourself, I guess.
Yeah. Cause you have to, as a independent voice actor, you have to list what you, or at least what people perceive you as being able to do. Do you sound authoritative or trustworthy, or are you an angry voice? Are you a silly voice? Are you a, all of those things factor into even just doing a simple, local hair salon commercial or whatever.
Yeah.
It all fits.
And so do you find, for you personally, how do you help grow that? Is it training that you've been doing, or what do you do to help grow that?
I would say that some of the work you'll get as a voice actor is will be like you audition, they send you a script, and you can send them like three different takes of that script, so they have something to play with. Or it will be a live directed session online, which a lot of people, I think, prefer to do. So you will get immediate feedback on it as to what they want you to try or how they want you to sound. And the good ones will help you find it. Sometimes it's just a matter of like, look, just say it like this. And that's fine, too. You have to be, on my website it says, my mindset is to serve the script. So it's not about me. It's about your product. So I want to make that sound good, even if you have to treat me dumb and tell me how you want me to sound. That's fine.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of selflessness involved too.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. It's funny. I was just having a conversation with a stunt performer about the same thing. Is that we kind of are a bit narcissists because we are the product.
Yep.
And so we think it's like me. No. The goal needs to shift to the customer, right? Because that's what it is.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things that we did well in improv was an ensemble mindset. It's my job to make everybody else look good. And if everyone's doing that, everybody looks good.
Yes.
So bringing that to voiceover or to whatever performance, you know, expression you have is, I think, is also very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any other advice for people who are interested in pursuing a career in voiceover or just doing a career shift in general?
You know, so much of that really depends on phase of life. Are you married? Are you single or divorced? Do you have kids? Do you have grandkids if it's, you know, second act? People my age who have grandkids already, so that's like still blows my mind, but okay. My first step of advice would be to take some time and examine what's important to you. And then work your performance desire into that as opposed to making everything else work around your performance desire. Because you are, most of us at least, are part of an ensemble in life. Family, coworkers, friends. And it comes back to that, you know, making other people look good. And hopefully you have people around you who want to make you look good and will, you know, sacrifice or, you know, enable you, help you to do that, at least for a time. My whole thing is try it. Like, I tried voiceover. I'm still trying voiceover. I tried stand-up, and I learned a lot about that. You know, don't go into it thinking, I'm going to do this forever. I'm going to be great at it. Like, give it a shot. And keep trying until it stops being fun. Could be an approach.
I think that's great advice, honestly. Yeah. You have mentioned your family couple times. How would they describe what you do?
Gosh. They would describe it as, by now it's just, that's just dad being dad. That's just him. I'm a lot of people get the impression that I'm very outgoing and very, very loud and very silly all the time. On all of those like personality tests, I peg the introvert scale. I'm normally on my own, just very shy, not shy, very quiet. And I get charged up by being alone. I get my energy, my batteries recharged by being alone, and they get drained by being around a lot of other people. But when I'm in front of people, it's totally different. There's no one's taking anything from me. That's me giving out, you know, showing my age. Johnny Carson, who used to host The Late Show here on NBC in the States, said that he feels more comfortable in front of 10 million people than in a room of 10 people.
Oh, interesting.
And I understand that. Yeah. So I'm not the life of the party. Nobody would ever describe me as that. Unless somebody needs to be because something dumb is happening and okay, let's lighten this up a little bit. They would say, oh, he's on. Oh, now he's not on. It's a switch.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Interesting. I like that idea of, performing in front of people. Like, there's nobody taking anything away from you. I love that thought, right? You're giving to them,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
I love that.
That's a selfless kind of performing.
Yeah.
And a lot of what we see and a lot of, at least annoys me personally, is people who want to perform because it's mostly about them taking something. Mm. Like doing kid shows or doing performing stuff, there is a sense of satisfaction in it.
Of course.
There is. That's why else, you know, would you do it? But I like to make people happy. I like to make people laugh. That's the giving part. And there is an amount that comes back from that experience. Mm-hmm. As opposed to purely, look at me. I'm an amazing performer. Give me your souls. I don't have that time for that.
Well, and I think if that was the sole purpose, that would be the probably number one cause of why people would either stop doing this or burn out from doing it.
Yep.
Because there's no way, if that's the pure fuel for your fire, that doesn't exist, right? That's you're not going to get that constant positive affirmation at you.
Very rarely, yeah.
Yeah. And if it stops, you're just going to get disappointed and depressed, and then you'll quit.
Yep.
So there has to be another motivation.
Yeah.
And it has to be extrinsic to you, I think. I totally agree.
Yeah, it's a giving. It's a giving thing.
Yeah. Is there anything you're looking forward to this year, now that we're kind of coming out of, fingers crossed, the pandemic?
I am looking forward to maybe trying stand-up again. Because when I took a class in Portland, and it was a great class, the teachers were great. It was after the class that was hard. Doing comedy is, it's not about necessarily like, it's funny, it's not about being funny. It's about, what am I saying? To feel successful at it, you have to find your audience. Mm. And what I mean by that is, Brian Regan, comedian, to me, is one of the funniest people on the planet. I can listen to him. I do listen to his stuff over and over, and I laugh every time. Because for whatever reason, I resonate with his delivery and his kind of humor. And there are people who hate Brian Regan. I still love Steve Martin comedy to this day. There are some people who that's not their thing. And when you're learning how to do stand-up, the next logical, the next real thing you can do is to go to what are called open mic nights. So like bars and places will have a time once a week where people can come in and try their material on an audience. Sadly, most of that audience is other comedians waiting to go up who, you know, don't necessarily laugh at your stuff, not because they're being competitive, but because they're like, they're analyzing, like, okay, that was funny,
right?
That was hilarious. Yeah. I'm laughing really hard right now. But a lot of that level of comedy is lowest common denominator comedy. It's aimed at getting a laugh at whoever's there, as opposed to you doing your style of comedy and hoping there's somebody in the room who resonates with that. So when I say the hardest part is finding your audience, that's what I mean. Because not everybody's going to be your audience. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're not funny. It just means, okay, the people who like the sex and drugs and masturbation jokes, that's their crowd. That's not my crowd necessarily. But that's, you know, keep trying until you find your crowd. And that takes a lot, because it's to get up and tell a joke that you wrote, whether it's the first draft or the 100th draft, and it doesn't go anywhere. It's like, okay, I never want to do this again.
Yeah.
Ever. Yeah. So it's more challenging than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. What keeps that drive going? Like, when that happens, how do you keep going?
Well, because the next time might be completely different. So it's always about reworking your material and learning how to be sensitive to the audience. And the more you do it, the more you can kind of look around the room and go, okay, who's here? Do I need to modify anything so that it maybe lands a little differently for this group of people, as opposed to the way I have memorized and written down?
Yeah.
Or maybe this room's not going to get that joke. Maybe I have another one I need to work into that spot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah. And if it's not, so the school I work at, I get told pretty regularly, you're so funny. And I'm not trying to do stand up. I'm just in the moment saying something, or an email I wrote is in a, you know, it's hard to make technical emails interesting. So I try to come up with creative ways to communicate that stuff, and they appreciate it. So maybe stand-up isn't the thing. Maybe I can be content with making people laugh in the world that I'm around. Who knows?
Who knows?
But it's fun to try.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you tied exactly right back to, like, your career in preaching and stuff like that with the whole idea of listening to the audience and taking in the audience as humans and what's going to work and what's not going to work, as well with improv, right? And not following a script and being confident. Mm-hmm. And also I think the idea that not everyone is going to like you. So the goal of doing this is not to make everyone like you, because that's how you're going to burn out.
Yep.
It's for giving to them.
Yeah, you're going to burn out, or you're going to compromise who you are.
Mm.
Which is when you switch into selfish mode, because you want that laugh, you want that stimulus, as opposed to feeding them and giving them something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that, again, that kind of like ties into what you, the conversation you were saying you had with your wife about like who's funny, who's better, scripted versus not scripted. Yeah. Same thing, like who's people who don't compromise their values and kind of, I think, would probably be quote unquote funnier or just more entertaining to watch, right?
Yeah.
Just because there's a confidence there, there's a comfortability there, there's a human there, not trying to people please.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, so interesting. Comedy's so interesting, I think.
Yeah, I love that's, again, that's where I love the behind the scenes stuff. Like, you know, you see interviews with Jerry Seinfeld and or comedians talking to comedians about their work, and they're so different, but they have found their style and their audience. And, you know, someone who goes to see Dave Chappelle is not going to go see Jerry Seinfeld necessarily, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. But they're buddies and they can hang out, and they each do their thing well.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a respect there for craft, and absolutely.
Sure. Like Jerry never swears.
Yep.
He thinks you don't need that in stand up, so he just doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. finding your audience, finding your own self, what makes you a person, not necessarily what makes you funny, but what makes you you and what you want to share.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that. Any final, this has been filled with words of wisdom. Any final words of wisdom? I haven't had many, like, many people chatting about comedy. Comedy's such a, I'm going to reiterate, it's what a beast, right?
It's just, it's a huge animal.
Yeah.
I don't know about final words of wisdom, but.
No pressure.
Just, if you feel like you need to try it, try it.
Yeah.
It's okay. And be okay with not being amazing at it. Or, just give it a shot, because I'd rather try and not do great and be like, oh, why didn't I do that?
Thank you everyone for tuning in, and thank you Corby for being my guest this week. I hope you enjoyed his wonderful story about yo-yos, preaching, stand-up comedy, and improv. Again, I'll say it once, I'll say it again. Improv, honestly, is the best thing, has been the best thing for me as a second act actor to get out of my head, as they all say. I know we hear that all the time in the acting industry, but getting out of my logical-based world that I used to live in and into just free-flowing creativity. And I think Corby agrees with me on this one. Thank you, Corby, again for being my guest, you wonderful human being. I hope you'll tune in next week for another episode of Second Act Actors. Bye! Second Act Actors is produced and edited by me, Janet McMorty. Theme music by Guillaume, additional sound editing by David Studio, additional video editing by Jackie Wadewer, show notes written by Sarah Hopkinson. I record using Riverside FM. If you're interested in developing an interview-based webcast like mine, I highly recommend this platform. Shoot me an email and I'll direct you to the wonderful folks there. If you or someone you know is interested in being a guest, email me at secondactactors@gmail.com. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with your friends. My love language is words of affirmation, so compliments, constructive criticism, and feedback are always welcome and encouraged. Negative Nancys, Judgy McJudgersons, or Debbie Downers, unless you're Rachel Dratch, regarding me or my guests are not welcome. It takes serious courage to share your story with the world, so if you're tempted to negatively comment about someone else's story, please ask your therapist why you're such a garbage person. Save the drama for the stage. On that happy note, I hope you'll tune in next week for another episode of Second Act Actors. Bye!